Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 23rd of March 2019. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of some good bits of national radio coming up in the next few days. After that, we have another in our series of Community Matters interviews with a local volunteer group. And then we have another In Concert feature, highlighting some of the musical performances coming up in the next few weeks. Today's music is called Nature Walk and is by Arian Lees. But before we begin the programme, I'd like to play you a short clip courtesy of Radio Verulam, which was recorded at the Mayor's Pride Awards held in St Albans last week.
Now to my second award and the final award of the evening, which is the Mayor's Recognition Award. And this is an award to an inspirational individual or group making an outstanding impression on the Mayor in their year of office. And I'm delighted to announce that this year the Mayor's Special Recognition Award goes to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper. Its weekly audio programme is sent out free of charge, helping those with limited sight stay in touch with what is going on in St Albans, Harpenden and the villages. Every week it covers top news items, readers' letters to the Hearts Advertiser and the Review, together with interviews, music and more to entertain it and inform its listeners. I've known the organisation over quite a long time now, and I've had an opportunity on several occasions to speak with their listeners in person, and it is very, very apparent just how much they value this service and how important it is to them in keeping in touch with what is happening in their local community. It is a thoroughly deserved award, and in this, I think it's your 45th year, I commend it for all that it has done and continues to do in our community since 1974.
Representative from the Talking Newspaper receiving a very well-deserved Mayor's Recognition Award for the wonderful work that they do.
I'm now here with Sue Fennell, who is the Secretary of St Albans and District Talking Newspaper. Congratulations on the Mayor's Recognition Award, Sue.
Thank you very much indeed. Brilliant.
And for anyone that's not familiar with St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, can you tell us a bit about what you do?
We record on the Thursdays, that particular day's Hearts Advertiser articles from it. And then on the Friday, a smaller team go in and copy the recording and send it out in the post. It goes out on USB sticks that can be used in the boombox that we've already supplied to the potential listeners. And then there is no postage for it, and there's no postage when they return to us.
So it's to help people with limited sight stay in touch with what's going on in the community, is that right?
It is primarily, mainly for them, but we've now realised that our constitution allows us to send them out to people who've had strokes and therefore unable to open a newspaper and follow through on the newspaper.
Okay.
So there are a lot of people out there we would love to have as listeners, but it's getting in touch with them and finding them.
And if there is anyone listening that would like to get in touch, how can they go about doing that?
It depends what they want to do. They can go online at St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, or they can get through to us through the sensory services from the Hearts County Council, or they can get to us through the Hearts Vision Loss. So there are a number of people who know about us and who can send people our way if they can't get... A word of mouth is the other good one.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you, Sue, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much indeed.
So there we are. We've won the Mayor's Recognition Award for this year, and we're very grateful to the Mayor. It's very pleasing for our work to be recognised like this. And while we're on the subject, we'd also like to thank you, our listeners, for your continuing support for us. Without you, there'd be no point us turning up. Now, I've been asked once again by our distribution people to remind you to please make sure that when you return the programme wallet to us, it's completely zipped up. We're still having some instances where the wallet has arrived half unzipped and the memory stick has fallen out. And can we also remind you to please return the memory stick in its wallet as soon as you have finished listening to it? To delay returning it means we need to buy more memory sticks and wallets in order to have enough to send out every week. And so thank you very much on both those points. So, after all that, let's get on with the programme. And as usual, our first item is the news. And our readers today are Fran, Leslie, Jean and Fiona.
Hello, my name is Fran. My first article is headed Damning Findings in Thameslink Investigation as £5 million fine imposed. Govia Thameslink has been fined £5 million by the rail regulator over the chaos caused by the introduction of the May 2018 timetable. The Office of Rail and Road imposed the fine after it found that GTR failed to provide appropriate, accurate and timely information to passengers following the introduction of a new timetable last May. An investigation launched in October last year has produced some damning findings, including ghost trains arriving at stations with passengers and staff unaware of their arrival, services being removed from the timetable without passengers being told, and trains being removed or cancelled on a daily basis. The findings will come as no surprise to passengers using Great Northern and Thameslink services in Harts and beyond, whose calls for a January price freeze on fares fell on deaf ears. The disruption experienced by many passengers as a result of the May timetable introduction was awful, said Stephanie Tobin, Deputy Director of Consumers at ORR. When disruption happens, poor quality information makes an already difficult and frustrating situation worse. The exceptional circumstances that followed the introduction of the timetable meant that providing perfect advance information for passengers was from the outset an impossible task, and GTR's overriding focus was on providing as much capacity as it could to meet customer demand. However, persistent and prolonged failures in information provision meant that passengers couldn't benefit from the operational improvement it was trying to make. In response, GTR CEO Patrick Verwer said, "We are disappointed at the fine imposed by the Office of Rail and Road. We are making significant improvements to information for passengers. These include upgrades to station screens, issuing frontline staff with new smartphones loaded with real-time service information, and we have volunteer teams on standby to help passengers during disruption. Further improvements in custom information are planned." The severe disruption following last May's timetable introduction was due to industry-wide factors, and we are sorry for the serious effect this had on our passengers. GTR has paid £18 million in passenger compensation and is investing a further £15 million in improvements for passengers for its part in the timetable issues.
Hello, my name is Leslie. My first article is headlined Tribute Match in Memory of Tragic Saints Player. St Albans City Football Club is dedicating a match in tribute to former player and Love Island star Mike Thalassites. Mike, who helped the Saints retain their National League South status after signing for the club in 2016, was found dead on Saturday morning in a park near his childhood home in Edmonton, North London. His death is not being treated as suspicious. Known to his teammates as Thaler, the Cyprus under-19 and under-21 international scored 6 goals in 13 starts in the National League South, with 2 appearances off the bench. He also played for the Saints once in the Hearts Senior Club and the Hearts Charity Cup. Tom Bender, who played alongside him for St Albans City, said he was a very confident person. He loved being at the centre of attention in the changing rooms. People loved him and he made everyone laugh. One of the things we'd look forward to most on a match day was the stories he would tell in the car. When my son was born and I was changing careers outside of football, he was really helping me get a job and it was something I was always grateful for. It was not a side of Thaler that people saw. The person that I'll remember is someone who always loved having a laugh and never took himself too seriously and just wanted to have fun and always had a smile on his face. Before playing for St Albans, Mike began his football career at Stevenage Football Club, where he was given his first professional football contract in 2011. He also had stints at Bishop Stortford, Chelmsford City and Concord Rangers. Tom said it didn't take long for him to immerse himself with the team. There were a few of us who had a really close bond. We formed a bond that lasted longer than the time we were in the club together. Responding to the news of his death, St Albans City said on social media that they were shocked and saddened. They tweeted, "The team, fans and all those who worked with Michael during his time at the club have very fond memories and pass on their deepest sympathies to his family and friends." During his time playing for the club, Mike scored 6 goals in 17 games, once scoring the vital goal which won an away game against Maidenhead. Manager Ian Allinson said, "They were all important games because we were in a relegation battle at the end of 2016 and those goals were vital. He was a great lad. He was very jovial and very funny. He had a laugh and a joke, but when he had to take a serious side, he could be serious. When it came to football, he took it very seriously. He was a good player. It's such a sad situation to be in at such a young age. There's not been one bad word about the boy. He was infectious in the way he went about everyday life. It just seems so sad. In my mind, you have to wonder why." Mike appeared in the 3rd series of Love Island in 2017. On the show, he was affectionately known as Muggy Mike after being a hit with the ladies. Last year, Mike joined the 4th series of Channel 4's Celebs Go Dating and was represented by Neon Management at the time of his death. He had also been planning to open a cafe called The Skillet in Loughton, Essex, with floral tributes left outside at the weekend. St Albans City FC's game against Gloucester City FC on Saturday will be dedicated to Mike. Kick-off is at 3 p.m. in Clarence Park, and a number of former players will be coming to support the game. There will be a minute's applause before kick-off in honour of Mike, and the club will be collecting for It's OK to Say and local mental health charity Youth Talk.
Hello, this is Jean reading for you, and my article concerns children. And the care system for children has gone up 10 placements in a 12-month period. More than 100 children in care in Hertfordshire have had 3 or more placements in the past year, according to the latest data from the County Council. And some of those looked after children have notched up as many as 10 different placements. The data was presented to the latest meeting of the Council's Children, Young People and Families Cabinet Panel. It showed that as of December 2018, there were 846 looked-after children in Hertfordshire and a further 113 unaccompanied asylum-seeker children. Of those children, 128 had had three or more different placements in the past 12 months. Councillor Anthony Rowlands asked for a report to outline what the council is doing to address the issue. A spokesman for Hertfordshire County Council said, "Children and young people in care move placements for a range of reasons regarding their complex needs. Hertfordshire Children's Services work alongside foster carers and residential homes to provide support for placements and to maintain stability for children wherever possible." The committee also heard that for the first time in Hertfordshire, more children were leaving care through special guardianship orders than through adoption. A special guardianship order appoints one or more individuals to be a child's special guardian when they cannot live with their birth parents and would benefit from a legally secure placement. It is less secure than an adoption order because it does not end the legal relationship between child and birth parents. According to the data, in the 12 months between September 2017 and 2018, 16.1% of those leaving care did so with a special guardianship order, compared to 11.2% being adopted. In the 12 months prior to this, 16.6% of those leaving care were adopted, and 10.9% had a special guardianship order. A Hertfordshire County Council spokesman said, "Hertfordshire Children's Services' aim is for children to have permanence in order to have happy and healthy childhoods. Whether this is achieved via a special guardianship order or an adoption order is related to the specific circumstances of the individual cases. There has been a national rise in the use of special guardianship orders as an outcome from care proceedings, often meaning children are achieving permanence with an extended family member."
Hello, I'm Fiona, and my first story has the headline, "Councillor claims B&Bs are an inhuman form of temporary accommodation." A campaign is in place to get the council to stop issuing bed and breakfast accommodation to homeless people. Councillor Reverend Robert Donald has twice raised the issue of the unsuitability of this kind of temporary accommodation with St Albans District Council, and it is now going to be debated at the next meeting of Cabinet. This means it could soon become policy not to temporarily house people in B&Bs and hotels. Councillor Donald is proposing that by December 2020, bed and breakfasts are used only as one-off unforeseen circumstances. Councillor Donald said, "The use of bed and breakfast as temporary accommodation for the homeless has become a routine practice of the council rather than an occasional one-off last resort. Especially for homeless families with children, this is an inhuman form of temporary housing in the 21st century. At a time when they need the support of friends, family and the community nearby to help most, we are taking many of the homeless away from their community support and placing them outside the district at council taxpayers' expense, in Premier Inns or travel lodges in Hatfield, Boreham Wood, Luton or Welwyn." Councillor Donald maintained that education is disrupted and children's personal development is threatened. He said that at a time when they need maximum stability, families are being put under greater emotional stress. One woman had paid £40 a day in taxi fares to keep her child at Fleetville School as she was accommodated out of the area. Councillor Brian Ellis, Housing and Inclusion Portfolio Holder, said, "The council has a statutory duty to house homeless people. At present, we have 138 households in temporary accommodation, of which six are in B&B, reducing to three by the end of this week. Our policy is not to use B&B unless there is no alternative. We are having to do so at present, partly because an 8-unit block we own has been damaged by flooding. It is being repaired and will be back in use in May. We are also acquiring more temporary accommodation. I hope that this, plus other measures we are taking, will minimise our use of B&B. The issue will continue to be debated at tonight's Cabinet meeting.
Long-term strategic master plan for future Christmas events to be devised. A long-term master plan for the St Albans Christmas event is being drawn up to avoid more disappointing festivities. St Albans Christmas offering has drawn criticism ever since it was established in 2013, which peaked when the long-awaited Meraki Christmas Festival fell flat last December. Organisers hit numerous stumbling blocks, starting when a small group of disgruntled residents opposed its location on the water meadow opposite Westminster Lodge. The years previous to 2018, run by St Albans District Council, had also racked up a bill of more than £300,000. Members of the SADC Community, Environment and Sport Scrutiny Committee have now recommended that the Council's portfolio holder for business and the community, Councillor Sally Gegezuz, should produce a Christmas events plan for the next 3 to 5 years. This should be created in cooperation with St Albans BID, the chapter of St Albans Cathedral, and other interested groups, some of which addressed the committee. Chair of the Abbey Precinct's Residents Association, Peter Trevelyan, said it had been the wrong event in the wrong location, and holding it in the water meadow conflicted with plans to revitalise the River Wear and improve wildlife. Ian Smith spoke on behalf of the residents of Pondwick's Close, a road adjacent to Verulamium Park, close to the festival site. He said a Christmas festival or market belonged in the city centre rather than the park. Martin Goodman, chair of the Abbey Theatre, said Verulamium Park's water meadow should not become an events meadow. The committee's chair, Councillor Anthony Rowlands, said Christmas events are vital for shops, restaurants and other local businesses. Unfortunately, the Christmas offering in St Albans this year fell short of expectations and was rather disappointing. Consultation about the events in Verulamium Park was woeful. The committee's view was that we need to have a complete rethink and produce a detailed plan covering the next 3 to 5 years. That way, we should avoid the late decision-making which beset the 2018 events and achieve much firmer budgetary control. Councillors also said future events should also make use of historic buildings and be cost-effective, accessible, family-friendly and intergenerational.
Green activist group floating idea of balloons ban from council land. An environmental group is urging for balloons to be banned from council land as part of a new campaign. Plastic Free St Albans has launched a petition asking Herts County Council to forbid the use of balloons or sky lanterns on its land as part of the Marine Conservation Society campaign Don't Let Go. It has also called on local organisations to stop using the rubber decorations at promotional events, highlighting greener alternatives such as flags or bunting. Emma Tyers founded the group with members of St Albans and Harpenden Refuse the Straw, Sustainable St Albans and St Albans Friends of the Earth. She said, "Many people do not realise the damage caused by balloons and their ribbons, which are often found as river and beach litter, sometimes in the most remote places, where they can be ingested by sea creatures and birds and kill them. All released balloons, including those falsely marketed as biodegradable latex, return to Earth as ugly litter, dangerous to wildlife." different organisations in St Albans have thrown their backing behind the campaign. Chairman of the Ver Valley Society, John Pritchard, said, "We find balloons among litter on the River Ver around St Albans nearly every week, and they can be deadly for birds and wildlife. The Society is pleased to support the campaign. It's an excellent idea, and we urge local people who care about their environment to support it." Amanda Yeworth, from St Albans Friend of the Earth, said, "By all means use balloons for parties, but please make sure that you hold on to the balloons and dispose of them correctly. This campaign is focused on preventing mass littering events, not spoiling six-year-olds' birthdays. People get very annoyed about litter on the ground, but do not always understand that letting balloons float into the sky is simply another form of littering." Plastic-free St Albans, together with Sustainable St Albans, is also hosting a documentary film screening to raise awareness of these issues. Rubber Jellyfish will be shown at 7:30 p.m. on March 28th at Inn on the Park in Verulamium Park.
My next item is one more instance of objections to aircraft noise. A Harpenden campaign group has accused the local Conservatives of ignoring air traffic noise pollution in favour of other concerns. South Harpenden councillors sent out a questionnaire to residents, asking them to select their five greatest local concerns out of a list of 14, which included affordable houses, parking, social service, and local businesses. Members of the group Harpenden Sky were outraged that the effect of noise pollution from Luton Airport on residents was not one of the options on the list. Spokesman Neil MacArthur said, "Have South Harpenden councillors totally lost the plot? Air traffic noise is a recurring and fundamental issue where local council representatives have been significantly lacking in effective opposition. And now a confident Luton Airport has just announced another expansion plan. So at this moment of greatest need, South Harpenden are backing off." According to Harpenden Sky, a previous newsletter from the Conservatives in May 2018 promised they were fighting to change flight paths out of Luton Airport. Harpenden South councillors Brian Ellis, Teresa Heritage and David Heritage said they do care about airport noise, but the survey was targeting other areas. A joint statement from councillors said, "Protecting the residents of Harpenden from the environmental effects resulting from the operation of Luton Airport is business as usual for us. The survey we are doing in part of our ward is focused on these services that the three tiers of local government, town, district and county have direct control over, both financially and politically, and can therefore look to adapt or improve. The issues around aircraft noise and traffic are controlled by Luton Borough Council and Luton Airport Limited. The councillors who lobby these bodies all the time are committed to representing residents' views. It is completely incorrect for Harpenden Sky to give the impression that local councillors do not care about this issue. The survey includes a box asking about local concerns, and so far, 3 out of 70 respondents have mentioned aircraft noise."
Big Lesson was taught to 2,500 pupils for British Science Week. St Albans teachers delivered a lesson to more than 2,500 pupils in a world record attempt for British Science Week. Sandringham and Verulam schools in St Albans and Ridgeway Academy in Welwyn Garden City took part in the Big Lesson last month, attempting to break the world record for biggest lesson ever taught. Chemistry teachers Barry Lee from Sandringham, Lee Knowles from Verulam and Beth Herkus from Ridgeway taught a lesson to Year 8 pupils from Sandringham School's Sandpit Theatre as part of British Science Week, which offers pupils opportunities in the STEM subjects, that is science, technology, engineering and maths. The lesson was broadcast live online so that other students from all three of the schools could participate with their own classrooms, with 2,500 pupils taking part in total. The three teachers taught pupils about the periodic table to celebrate 150 years since it was devised from the work of Russian chemist Dmitry Mendeleev. All pupils had resource materials and, following a demonstration, were given a short learning task to complete in their classroom before the next demonstration. Throughout the hour, more information was covered with various levels of challenges to meet the needs of the pupils from years 7 to 13. The final activity was a quiz on game-based learning platform Kahoot, and other internet users joined in, bringing the number of players up to 25,000 and eventually crashing the system. Verulam head teacher Paul Ramsey said, "This event demonstrated the power of working in partnership and to how to raise aspirations for all students wherever they are located." All three schools are part of the Auburn Academies Trust, which aims to raise the performance of all pupils. Sandringham School head teacher Alan Gray said, "Working with Verulam and Ridgeway schools adds significant value to everything that we do. I would like to thank all the science staff and technicians who worked so hard to stage this unique event, and the senior staff at all three schools for having the vision to see how collaboration can have such a profound impact on learning. Well done, everyone." And the article is accompanied by a large picture of lots of boys and girls in an assembly hall, all seated down, all very involved and engaged, solving these problems, scratching their heads, and, as I say, having a fantastic time.
New lambs are born with a spring in their step. Students made use of their training at an annual lambing event in a St Albans college. Becoming experts in their field, agriculture students helped farm manager Del Knowles to deliver 19 new lambs at the Oaklands College Lambing Weekend on March 16th and 17th. 10,000 visitors flocked to the lambing barns and enjoyed a variety of farmers' market refreshments over the weekend, including fresh apple juice and locally sourced honey. There was also a children's farm trail around the college, which included activity sheets and stickers. Dell said, "This year represented another hugely successful year for lambing at Oaklands College, with our agriculture students gaining valuable experience of live lambing and community event management." Angerland Park and Ride provided free shuttle transportation from near the University of Hertfordshire, and the event was sponsored by SA Law. More than 300 new lambs are expected to be born at the college during the season, which runs from February to April. And there's a lovely couple of pictures to accompany this one smiling lady. It's probably the Lady Dell holding a lamb which actually has black ears and a black nose and black around its eyes, but is white and black feet. And also a very graphic picture of a lamb, I think, being pulled out of its mother ewe in the hay.
My next article is about new recruits for Safer Neighbourhood Team. A group of four highly experienced recruits have been welcomed to the Neighbourhood Force. The Safer Neighbourhood Team have taken in two police officers and two police community support officers to cover several areas in Hertfordshire. PC Steve Whittaker and PC Lauren Wilson are now covering London Coney, St Stephen's and the St Albans East Team. St Albans Neighbourhood Inspector Andy Wiseman said, "I'm really pleased to welcome these officers who've hit the ground running and are already proving to be real assets to the two neighbourhood teams. They have both dealt with community issues and concerns including criminal damage, burglaries, antisocial cycling, as well as carrying out drug warrants. Police community support officers Bradley Flanagan and Matt Bennett have joined the St Albans Central, North and West Safer team. PCSO Flanagan will be covering the Clarence Ward, while PCSO Bennett will be working in the Verulam Ward. To speak to the police, call them on 101.
A former homeless man has teamed up with charity. A homeless man has teamed up with the St Albans charity that saved his life to launch a house clearance service. Andy McGuinn, who lived for 5 months on the street before moving into Emmaus, Hertfordshire in August 2017, manages the charity's house clearance service as a full-time paid member of staff. St Albans-based charity Emmaus supports up to 39 formerly homeless people by giving them a home, meaningful work in a social enterprise, and an opportunity to regain lost self-esteem to help rebuild their lives. Andy's story is a picture of how suddenly homelessness can strike. Before finding himself on the streets, Andy had worked his whole life, including 9 years in the army, and he had just opened a bakery. But his life fell apart after the breakdown of his marriage. He said, "My wife and I had been married for 30 years and had 8 children when she decided to leave me. Our marriage had been going downhill for a long time and one wasn't the same after our 6-month-old daughter passed away 15 years before. Andy found himself with no home and no income and went on to spend 5 months on the streets. He said, "I think being ex-army and being homeless during the summer helped me to survive. I chose a quiet area under a bridge by a running stream to avoid people, and so I could catch fish to eat. I didn't have to get handouts or beg, which was something I didn't want to do. But it was not until a run-in with the police and a 4-week stint in prison that Andy sought the help of Emmaus. Andy initially worked in the charity's second-hand shops before he was approached to help with house clearances, and in December was offered the full-time role of manager. With full-time employment, Andy is on the Emmaus Move On scheme, which allows residents to stay in the community for 3 months while saving for a deposit to move into their own place. Residents are supported through the scheme and receive a leaving fund to help with moving expenses. There are currently 29 Emmaus communities across the country supporting 804 formerly homeless people in the UK. The charity hopes to offer 1,000 places by 2020. Well, good luck to them.
And now news of another charity. This charity puts on a therapeutic performance for a care home. Residents at a care home in Harpenden were treated to an afternoon of opera, courtesy of a musical entertainment charity. Willow Court Care Home played host to a performance of Victorian vignettes by Connaught Opera, a charity which provides musical entertainment for older people in the South East. Family, friends and members of the public also came to watch the performance. The show, partially funded by the Hertfordshire Community Foundation, concluded with a variety of popular hits including "I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside" and "Don't Dilly Dally, My Old Man Said Follow the Van." The performance was particularly enjoyed by 100-year-old resident Connie Pacey, who sang along heartily to every song. As the show came to an end, Connie presented Connaught Opera with flowers and wine as a token of gratitude for their visit. Quantum Care, a non-profit care provider of 26 care homes, including Willow Court, has a long-standing relationship with the charity. Connaught Opera consists of two singers, soprano Maria Araki and baritone Glenn Wilson, and they are accompanied by a pianist, Nicholas Bosworth. Quantum Care marketing manager Cassie Larham said, "Not all of our residents are mobile enough to go to the opera, so when we are given the opportunity to bring the opera to them, we were not prepared to miss out." Willow Court has its very own choir that meet weekly, and they encourage new members from the home and the local community to join. "We see firsthand the therapeutic effects music and singing have on our residents and daycare members," Cassie explained. In September, all 26 Quantum Care homes will receive 10 tickets to attend the annual performance at Nebworth House Stately Home, an event that is put on exclusively by Connaught Opera for Quantum Care residents. Since January 2003, Connaught Opera have arranged and performed around 200 concerts a year for older people in the South East. And again, this story is accompanied by a lovely photo of Connie handing over some wine and some flowers to the singer Maria, who is also in, I would say, old-time musical costume, and the baritone Glenn Wilson in a very smart suit and a dapper bow tie.
Easter Eggs Collection. A young man from Harpenden has come up with an excellent idea to raise money for the hospice where his late grandfather died. 11-year-old Brett Henman of Glemsford Drive set up an online plea for chocolate egg donations for Keach Hospice in Luton, where the grandfather he never met spent the last days of his life. The hospice is fundraising by selling little knitted chickens with Cadbury's cream eggs inside. The chickens are knitted by members of the public and sell for £1 each. The Sir John Law's pupil and his mum put out a request for eggs on a Harpenden social networking page and were amazed by the generosity of strangers and friends. Brett has over 200 eggs so far. His mum, Hannah, said, "I've always taught Brett that kindness is free. He had this idea to get donations of cream eggs for the hospice to sell inside the knitted chickens. I am really proud of him. One man brought a box of 48 eggs round to our house. And there's a lovely picture of Brett looking over a huge pile of Cadbury's cream eggs with his thumb up in the air.
The next article is another report of the big cat seen in the area. Video footage may have captured the moment the controversial St Albans big cat entered a back garden filled with rabbits. Former sceptic Ollie Fairbrother and his wife Natasha have released a new recording, captured on March the 14th, showing a spotted feline dashing up and over their garden fence. The couple, who keep lots of small animals, such as 26 rabbits and some guinea pigs, said chicken wire has, until now, stopped the cat gaining entrance to the property. Outwitting the protection, it instead ripped a large section of bolted corrugated plastic from the roof of an enclosure, something Ollie believes a domestic cat would be unable to do. Natasha, who has spotted the animal three times now from about 6 to 10 feet away, said its body was about 3 feet long and came up to her knee. Ollie said, "I'm not a big cat expert, so I really don't know, and I'm sure there is a logical explanation, but I've seen the video and know how shaken Natasha is by it. It's not one of those in-the-distance sightings, and I know you can get big domestic cats, but this is big." Their property, which formerly housed an animal boarding business called Fairbrother Farm, is opposite Oaklands College, where in January 2017, staff members also reported seeing a big sandy cat. There is another video of the supposed big cat, which was captured in June 2017 by a taxi driver along Knapsbury Lane at about 4:30 a.m. Ollie added, If there is an explanation, that might also explain the sightings at Oaklands College too. I saw that video the taxi driver took, and to me that looked like a normal cat. But he obviously thought it was huge, and we never got the perspective. It is hard to get across when it is something of that size. For us, something of that size is a concern. With a three-month-old baby, the couple are petrified to keep windows open in case it returns and harms the youngster. There is much debate about the existence of a supposed big cat, with staunch critics up against a wave of reported eyewitnesses. A Freedom of Information request in November 2016 revealed that Hearts Police received about 30 big cat reports in the 5 years previous. And there is a picture, quite clearly, it's a bit blurred, but you can quite clearly see this large cat with sandy colour and definite spots on it. Doesn't look like a domestic cat at all.
Now an item about a daughter who is so proud of her parents and the work they do, she's contacted the paper. A proud daughter has praised her parents for litter picking, a popular track and park for more than 5 years. Every day when Linda and Briar Stevenson take their dog Millie for a 45-minute walk along the Alban Way, they bring rubbish bags with them to pick up litter from Ashley Road to Nicholas Breakspear Catholic School, and they have made these public spaces clean and tidy for more than half a decade. Now their daughter Emma wants to publicly thank them on behalf of the community. She said, "I am really proud. I think it is a lovely thing to say they have done, keeping a highly used area very clean for a long time. It is very busy in the summer and very popular, and it is in between a few primary and secondary schools. My daughter uses it. Whenever Emma's three-year-old daughter joins her grandparents on the walk, she will also help to litter pick." Emma added, "They have never been thanked, it has never been acknowledged, and they have done it for so long." The Alban Way is a former railway which runs from Cotton Mill Lane in St Albans to Wrestlers Bridge in Hatfield, over 6.5 miles. Long Acres play areas are managed by St Albans District Council. Portfolio holder for the environment at SADC, Councillor Frances Leonard said, "Linda and Brian clearly care about their neighbourhood and want to keep it in the best possible condition. We owe them and the many other volunteers who are litter pickers in the district a big thank you." Councillor Leonard said she attended a litter pick organised by Sandridge Parish Council and hopes to join Linda and Brian on their walks at some point. She added, "As a council, we are committed to keeping our streets, parks and green spaces free of litter, and it is great to see people helping us with that task. We helped the Keep Britain Tidy campaign group for this year and will be taking an active role in their Great British Spring Clean, which starts later this month and runs for 4 weeks. Nationally, it is hoped around 500,000 people will help with litter picks, and we will be doing our bit in St Albans, together with our waste contractor Veolia, community groups and businesses. However, the best thing that could happen is for people to simply stop dropping litter."
And now let me bring you news of the Detox Challenge. Teachers and staff at the St Albans School ditched chocolate for a month and raised more than £700 for charity. 16 employees at St Albans High School for Girls took on the British Heart Foundation's Detox Challenge and avoided eating any chocolate for the whole of February. They initially wanted to raise at least £120 towards the charity, which funds research in heart and circulatory diseases, but actually collected £715.60. Chemistry teacher Abby Winters said, "I'm a true chocoholic and I struggle to go a couple of days without craving it. Over the Christmas period, my colleagues and I had indulged in one chocolate too many, and after seeing the detox challenge advertised, we decided that this was a great opportunity to raise money for a brilliant cause, whilst helping to put our mental strength to the test as well." She said it was a lot harder than she thought it would be. And the article is accompanied by a picture sent in from the school of all the teachers that took part at the very end of their challenge, obviously having been given chocolate biscuits or something, and they're just about to reintroduce chocolate into their diets. They're looking very proud of themselves.
And that's the end of the news. And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in the Hearts Advertiser this week. Dr. John Butcher, aged 84 years. Winifred Bradley. Winifred Harvey, aged 76. And John Tatham, aged 91. Now, another little bit of our offering from Airy and Lease, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days.
And now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. We start with Saturday the 23rd of March, and at 2:30pm on Radio 4, you can hear the final part of Chinatowns, the drama set in the Staffordshire Potteries during the Industrial Revolution. Then a treat for comedy fans. Tune in to Radio 4 Extra at 7pm for The Real Comedy Controllers, The Things That Made Us Laugh, a look back at favourite moments from the post-Second World War comedy archive. Over to Radio 4 at 8pm for Archive on 4, flat 113 at Grenfell Tower, a heartbreaking documentary which hears from survivors and firefighters about the decision to move residents into flat 113 on the 14th floor. Of the 8 people in this flat, only 4 survived. This is followed at 9pm by the second and final part of Ian Rankin's crime thriller, Rebus Flesh Market Close.
On to Sunday, 24th of March, and Pienaar's Politics at 10am on Radio 5. John Pienaar will bring you up to date with all the week's political highlights as Brexit looms ever closer. Or does it? At 11:15am on Radio 4 is Desert Island Discs, and Lorraine Laverne's castaway this week is Jacqueline de Rojas, the president of Tech UK, repeated on Friday 29th of March at 9am. Today's drama at 3pm on Radio 4 is Memento Mori. Patricia Hodge stars in a dramatisation of Muriel Spark's comic 1959 novel about a group of elderly people disturbed by a threatening anonymous caller. Then over to Radio 3 at 5:30pm for Words and Music, an exploration of the human body in poetry and prose, including works by Tennyson, Yeats, Emily Dickinson, Larkin, John Donne and Shakespeare, with music ranging from Bach and Chopin to Chaz and Dave.
And look now at some of the radio programmes that are broadcast at the same time each day this week. Book of the Week at 9:45am on Radio 4 each day is The Pianist of Yarmouk. Ehim Ahmad's account of how his life was turned upside down by the outbreak of the Syrian civil war in 2012 and how he risked his life under siege in Damascus by defying the Syrian regime with his music. Jane Austen fans will want to tune into Hannah Gordon narrating Mansfield Park, with contributions from Jane Lapoterre and Robert Glenister. This is over just 3 days, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, at 10 a.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Then an altogether different drama on Radio 4 at 12:04 each day is The Wall. This is the latest novel by John Lancaster, and it revolves around a young man tasked with defending a dystopian country walled off from a world ravaged by rising sea levels and populated by the Others. This week's Composer of the Week is Baroque master Ignaz Franz von Bieber. The son of a gamekeeper, he was born in 1644 in a small town in Bohemia. Tune in at 12 noon each day to hear about his life and works. At 1:45 each day on Radio 4 is The Puppet Master. Gabriel Gatehouse examines the story of Vladislav Surkov, who guided Vladimir Putin to the presidency of Russia. Starting with the 2014 protests in Kiev, the programme is both fascinating and disturbing.
Now for the highlights on Monday the 25th of March. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is the second and final part of Spain's Lost Generations, The Missing Children. Lucas Lawrenson joins families searching for loved ones who disappeared during Spanish Civil War and Franco's dictatorship. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4 is a new series of Brain of Britain, the General Knowledge Contest. This week, contestants from London, Cardiff and Romford take part. The Brexit Prime Minister is at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. Steve Richards concludes his look at Theresa May's leadership during Brexit by examining the 2018 Chequers deal and its turbulent aftermath.
On to Tuesday, the 26th of March. In Don't Log Off at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, a woman from Christchurch, New Zealand, recalls how the building opposite her office turned to dust in the earthquake that devastated large parts of the city in 2011. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 at 2 p.m. today has the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra with an all-English programme, featuring, among other works, Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending and Elgar's Enigma Variations and Pomp and Circumstance March No. 1. Or you may prefer today's drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, The Cairn. In this tragicomedy, two sisters are reunited in their rural childhood home in Kintyre as their ailing father approaches his death. They decide to construct a cairn for him, a mound of stones on top of a steep hillside, to commemorate him. But the local forestry commission are not best pleased. Finally, for Tuesday the 26th of March, the return of My Teenage Diary at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Rufus Hound's guest this week is Robert Peston, who reads from his 1974 diary.
A look now at Wednesday the 27th of March. Back for a second series is Black Music in Europe, A Hidden History. The musical theatre star Clark Peters looks at the variety of black music recorded in Europe from the late 1920s onwards, and explores the Degenerate Music exhibition in 1938 Dusseldorf, where people were encouraged to listen to jazz in booths and be horrified. Yet, to the annoyance of the Third Reich, the ordinary Germans loved it. This is at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 and then repeated at 9:30 p.m. The Monster Downstairs on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. explores how lonely the life of a child of an alcoholic can be. Hear the children's stories and how they manage to cope. This is followed at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 by the final part of A Charles Paris Mystery, Star Trap. Bill Nighy stars as the lovable, louche, actor-cum-amateur sleuth Charles Paris in Simon Brett's 1977 novel. Free Thinking at 10 p.m. on Radio 3 features Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet, writers of the BBC comedy series The Likely Lads, discussing the discovery of two missing episodes lost for more than 50 years.
On now to Thursday, the 28th of March, and we start with a new series of Radio 4's Crossing Continents at 11 a.m. Not many people know of the conflict brewing between Ukraine and Hungary. Both countries have expelled diplomats following a row over passports. Lucy Ann meets people in the border town of Berihov and investigates the deepening tensions there. Claire Balding's Ramblings at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 takes her this week to Smeaton's Tower Lighthouse in Devon. It was originally 12 miles out to sea, but in 1882 was replaced with a new structure and moved onshore to Plymouth Hoe. It's to be repeated on Saturday the 30th of March at 6:07 a.m. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. comes tonight from Aberystwyth Arts Centre and opens with Borodin's Prince Igor Overture, followed by Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5 in E minor.
And finally, we come to Friday the 29th of March. The University Time Bomb at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 looks at how universities are steeling themselves for a big hit on their finance in the wake of a recent ruling on how the government records student loans. What does this mean for the future of the over-18s education? This is followed at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 by Reluctant Persuaders, the second series of the sitcom about London's worst advertising agency. This stars Nigel Havers and Josie Lawrence. Then at 8 p.m. on Radio 2, Friday Night is Music Night is a real treat for David Bowie fans. Brent Havens conducts the BBC Orchestra and a rock band in a tribute to David Bowie, featuring symphonic arrangements of classics such as Life on Mars and Ziggy Stardust. Bob Harris presents the concert and shares personal recollections of Bowie, including archive material. What a note to end on.
And now, the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Sue Varville and Les Pedrick from Rennie Grove Hospice Care.
I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio today two representatives of an organisation that's really quite well known locally, the Rennie Grove Hospice Care. We're going to come back to Rennie Grove in a few moments, but first of all I want to welcome Sue Varville, who is the Director of Nursing and Clinical Services, and Les Pedrick, who is one of many, many, many volunteers at Grove House. He's going to tell us more about what he specifically does. Sue, the hospice movement actually is fairly recent, but the origins go back a long way in time, don't they? I mean, what does the word hospice mean?
The hospice movement and the approach really goes back to biblical times. There are references to it in the Bible to a place of rest for travellers, but we came into the modern movement, I suppose, in the 50s. Dame Cicely Saunders got interested in the fact that patients really weren't being cared for holistically, and so she started a movement and applied the principles of hospice approach to the care given to patients, initially in a hospice building, and set up St Christopher's Hospice in 1967.
Holistic, by that you mean?
It's not treating the illness and it's not treating the symptoms, it's treating the person as a whole, because the reality is when you have any illness, you have any anxieties that go around with that, concerns, misunderstandings, misunderstandings. So it's about sort of supporting people through that whole process. But clearly, initially, it was for people who were in the terminal stages of their lives. So the hospice movement at that stage was really linked to people who were certainly in palliative care, which is a non-curative care, but also really probably within the last year of their life. And that's continued to be the case. The government talks about end-of-life care, and for a number of years it's been considered to be the approach we take within the last year of life for someone deemed to have a prognosis for that length of time.
Could you deal with somebody who has a longer prognosis than that?
The trouble is nowadays you don't quite know. We talk about something called the surprise question in health at the moment, and GPs or us, when we're trying to assess patients, we're asked to say on some forms, oh, we would be surprised if somebody dies within the next year. Well, it's very, very difficult to say nowadays, because none of the illnesses that patients have that we care for, that's cancers and non-cancers, are predictable. Cancers are being treated very proactively and effectively nowadays. Early diagnosis is really good now. The testing, and actually the routine testing that GPs and the national programmes do, picks up all sorts of early signs, and therefore treatment is much more effective. There's research all the time, so people are having much more effective programmes of treatment. And when they are treated, very often, they go into remission. And although we might help people through a period of time when they are really unwell, they may have their treatment and be more unwell with treatment, but then they recover and then we discharge them, because that disease trajectory now is no longer a certainty. So people live with uncertainty of diagnosis, uncertainty of prognosis, and then, you know, hopefully we can help them to live a long and productive life after their illness.
It's about understanding how to live a life, is that right?
It's actually ensuring you reach your potential. I believe that sometimes patients will get a diagnosis and think, oh crikey, I've got to die now. So I think they learn to die, and we support them through that. And over the years, I think that's been the principal care of hospices, that we make sure people are comfortable, they don't feel anxiety, they have their family around them, but actually they may not die. So they don't want to be lying there waiting. We want them to be out there having a holiday and enjoying themselves and going to parties. And, you know, there's no reason why nowadays, with the treatment being quite as good as it is, that a great number of patients can't continue to live well with their illnesses. It's slightly less predictable for people with non-cancer diagnoses. So people with some elements of heart failure or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they're very up and down anyway throughout people's lives. They learn to live with that, and they still learn to maximise their living. So in a way, we're trying to apply that principle to both conditions, really.
And so although the assumption may be from people like me that you're dealing mostly with people who have cancer, in fact that is probably a large part of your patient base, but you do help people who have other chronic or life-threatening
conditions. We do. Probably about 80 to 85% of our patients have a cancer diagnosis, and the rest have non-cancer diagnoses. Because of the length of time we tend to care for patients, those with non-cancer would come perhaps later, when people are very sure that they would be in the latter stages. But I'd say the majority of our care in our adult team is with cancer diagnosis.
Let's talk now about Rennie Grove, because as I said at the beginning, it's a fairly well-known locally, because it's got good PR, it's good marketing, it makes itself visible, and you have to, because you need to raise a lot of money. Is it part of the NHS? Is it independent? How does this work?
We're a charity. We're a voluntary sector organisation, but we are funded to about 18% by the NHS. The remainder is raised by us and the very generous public out there in a number of ways. So at the moment, we have 28 shops across our patch, and we have a very active and efficient and effective fundraising team. We're setting our budget for next year of almost £8 million. So it's a huge amount. But we don't just cover Northwest Hearts. We have two teams in Northwest Hearts, but we cover quite a significant area of Buckinghamshire as well. So it's quite a large organisation, really.
And the size of that has come from the merger between two separate organisations. There was the Ian Rennie organisation, there was Grove House.
Yes.
And probably a lot of people in this area will know Grove House.
Yes.
It's physically within the grounds, as it were, of the hospital. Mm. But you cover two counties.
We do. Both organisations, when we worked separately, worked on supporting patients at home. Grove House by enabling people to come in for the day to day hospice and come to clinics to have sessions of occupational therapy and physiotherapy and be visited at home by those therapists. And Ian Rennie, who were based at that time in Decorum, had a hospice at home service that just visited at home. Now, we shared patients all the way through, right from the time we were both set up. So it was a very natural fit when the discussions were had about sharing a senior role to try and manage the organisations and share some costs and develop the services. And the chief exec at the time, Mark Lister, wanted us to set up hospice at home in St Albans to equalise the services that were available to patients. So it was a wonderful opportunity, actually. Mergers are always slightly difficult, and we know that we've got wonderful supporters in both organisations that found it slightly threatening at the time, but the success of it now is amazing. We're seeing more and more patients every year. Last year, almost 1,700 patients across our patch, 10% increase every year on the numbers of patients we see. It's huge.
So the increase also, therefore, in the need for volunteers and for funds. Absolutely. You are a volunteer with a keen eye on aspects of funding. I think that's right, isn't it? First of all, what do you volunteer as?
If you like, my day job is in the Grove House Day Hospice, and I give a day a week to that, working with a really good team of volunteers, most of whom have been volunteering for Any Grove much longer than I have.
Tell me what that means when you say you remember the day. Somebody, supposing I'm a patient, I come in, I am met by you or a medical person?
You're brought in by our wonderful volunteer drivers to start with, and they actually will deliver you, bring you through the door, and will give patients who've all got life-limiting conditions a day of activity, and that's kind of recreational, lunch, teas, coffees, that kind of thing, and hopefully send them on their way at the end of the day feeling perhaps a little bit brighter than they were when they started.
Why would I come into Grove House? I mean, if I don't want to mix with other people, I feel pretty rough, and you're going to make me sit down and play games or something. What do you do?
We always say to the patients, it's your day, you take from it what you like. If you want to join in the activity we've got, that's absolutely fine, and you know, we'll include you. If you want to sit apart, if you want a quiet day, if you're not feeling so great, and those things do happen, that's fine, we'll leave you alone and you can just have a day at ease, but knowing there's actually people around to engage with if you want to.
And if I'm in that situation, will I encounter a nurse or somebody who's medically trained so I can get some advice or more information?
All of the patients during the course of the day will have a one-to-one with a nurse where they can bring up any issues that are bothering them, can bring them up to date on their condition, can get advice. So yes, that clinical support is there, as well as the emotional support that I like to think that we volunteers give.
And how many volunteers would you have in one day?
In the day hospice, yes. The teams generally are around about six. Sometimes the number of patients fluctuate. I mean, we can have as many as 18, we can have as few as eight. But generally speaking, there are six of us. And obviously, the more volunteers you have per patient, the more personal attention, if you like, you can give them.
You're not only a volunteer specifically in this case, but also you are interested in promoting an understanding of Rennie Grove and fundraising?
When I retired 3 years ago or so, I went to work with a national charity for a short spell. Enjoyed it, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for. And then I lost two friends to cancer in fairly short order. And that's really what steered me towards Rennie Grove. And I got involved pretty much in the way of the day hospice, but then had it, if you like, a growing appreciation of all the good work that Rennie Grove do, and actually really wanted to put that out there to the public, knowing, as Sue said, how much we do rely on the public support. So that's very much what I see part of my role is doing now, albeit perhaps slightly more spasmodically than my day hospice role.
But is there a sort of a marketing team? I mean, you have a half a page in every week's Hearts advertiser, and that refers to lots of activities that are going on, the fun runs and whatever else. And is there a marketing team within Rennie Grove that's driving that? Is it a lot of it volunteering anyway?
There isn't formally. We do have a communications and marketing team. It's not huge. We try to put our funds into the clinical services, but of course, communications with our public and using people like Lester to get the message across is a really good way. We have some other people we train and call ambassadors, go and do talks on our behalf to companies and groups and interested people, really, with an aim to spread the word about the service for the patients, but also to encourage people to give if they can.
We've seen what Les does as a volunteer. Do you have lots of different types of volunteering?
Well, we have 1,500 volunteers, at least, at the moment. We had a look recently because we're very lucky. We submitted an application for Queen's Award for volunteering last year and were successful, and were awarded that this year. And we looked at the number of types of roles, and there were at least 74. And when we walk around our offices, you can't really tell whether they are volunteers or employed people. people because people are employed in all sorts of roles as volunteers. So in our finance department, fundraising department, we have clinical volunteers who support our nurses in every area, HR.
So would that mean that a retired nurse or even a GP or whatever could come and volunteer?
Yes, we would encourage anybody. I think everybody that volunteers on any level, in any role actually, gets something in return because it's a benefit. Everybody that we have has such special skills. They have their own individual personality. They have their own experience to bring to us. And it really adds to the service that we can give. And the background services, all the backroom services, finance, fundraising, HR, that we could manage those services without people like Les.
We're talking about volunteers, Les, of all sorts, and you mentioned drivers. Every winter, we may or may not have heavy snow. We've had some this year. We didn't have any last year, as far as I can remember. What happens when it snows? What do you need for that?
We're very fortunate in actually having a team of drivers, many of whom have all-weather cars, 4x4s and the like, and they've got tremendous commitment. I mean, as we like to think, all our volunteers have, but they actually go out in all weathers, and somehow they either get the patients in or they get the nurses out, and so the service continues in all weathers.
We did manage incredibly well recently with the snow. Even at night, we had the most amazing 4x4 drivers, or skilled drivers who had cars with chains, who were willing to take our nurses and visit patients. So we didn't stop our service at all. But anybody who's got a 4x4 experience and very happy to support us occasionally if they feel able, that's an ask.
How much time would a volunteer have to commit as a minimum?
I don't know, there is an absolute minimum. I do a day at day hospice and then I do ad hoc things on the advocacy and fundraising fronts. But people go in and do half a day in a shop. They do half a day in a tea bar at the magistrate's court. Pretty much whatever time you can spare, I think we would find a use for. And people shouldn't hold back because they think they can't give enough.
Now, you're medically trained yourself. You started out as a nurse.
Yes.
And you're now Director of Nursing and Clinical Services. Yes. Here you've got a team of professionally trained nurses. Do you have consultants coming in? What's the range?
We employ a doctor very part-time, one day, who comes into day hospice, actually, and does some medical assessments for the patients. We have about 90 nurses across all of our hospice at home teams. We've got 5 hospice at home teams based in some of the old PCT areas. So when I say in this area, Decorum and St Albans in Harpenden, we have one team in each of those. Each team serves probably a population of maybe 150,000 people, and that's the same in Buckinghamshire. So we have 5 teams of nurses. We have other supporters in those teams, healthcare assistants, who are trained care assistants who will go and do support visits and be the eyes and ears for the nurses. And we have healthcare assistants as well in day hospice. We have 2 occupational therapists, a physiotherapist, and we have a family support services team. Some have background in nursing, some are counsellors, so a range of practitioners. But we don't actually own our own consultant, so we access professional and specialist support from other agencies because they're not our patients. They're an NHS patient that needs support. We share the care with the GP, actually, so they remain the prescribing doctor and the lead in the care, so it's very much a shared activity.
So will every GP automatically say to their patients, I think you would benefit from being in touch with your local hospice?
That's where we tend to get our referrals from. GPs, district nurses, hospital consultants, outpatient clinics, hospital wards when they're discharging patients. But the GP is the key person. Day hospice is a great resource because it does have a very great clinical aspect to it. All patients are assessed. The great benefit to me is something Les was talking to me about earlier, is about the intervention of a volunteer. I like to call them an interested stranger because the patients will tell Les and other volunteers all sorts of things that they can't tell anybody else. There is a social side to day hospice, but it's not the majority of what we would say it represents. Now, if they're not able to come into day hospice, well, even if they're not even able to get to their GPs, that's really when the hospice at home team come into action. And we've got a team based here in St Albans and Harpenden, one in Decorum, and as I say, 3 in Buckinghamshire. And that's a 24-hour service. And they respond to the patient's needs. They plan the care with the patients. But then if the patient becomes unwell, they can ring any time, day or night. And they will get at least advice and then visits from the nurses. So they'll respond in the day. And we have an overnight team who covers the whole of our patch. It's quite big, but they do visit patients at night, which of course is the time when patients and their families feel most vulnerable. I have to say the 24-hour hospice at home service is unique in the country, the way that we have it in our organisation, and we are particularly proud of that. And how it works then, linking with Grove House, it gives us a real extra string to our bow to make it a kind of interactive service for patients, really, in this area.
So we're talking, obviously, about mostly here about adults in the way we're thinking, but you also deal with children, is that right?
We do. We have a children's hospice at home team, and we also have a family support team who look after the children of our adult teams who help support them. But our children's hospice at home team care for around 65 children a year across the whole of our area. Very different service because the children, their diagnoses are totally the opposite to our adults. So very luckily, childhood cancer is very rare. So it's about 80% of our children's service will be non-cancer. And they will be things like metabolic disorders, genetic disorders, certain syndromes that are very rare. And so we care for them, and we make care for them for a number of years, but they go up to the age of 19, and then we are reviewing at the moment how we care for those into other adult services because they do change.
Are we dealing here with a service which is free at the point of use? I mean, if somebody's called out in the middle of the night, the person who arrives, there's no cost to the patient?
No.
And there's no cost in the day hospice as well?
Or? Well, apart from nominal £5 that will provide them with their lunch and their teas and coffees throughout the day.
If there is a particular need for patients that have other elements of nutritional needs, we can get that from the NHS. That's a shared service. We are all trained, all the nurses are trained in guiding them on how to eat, because of course, when you're not well, you don't really want to. So it's just knowing what best to do while you're unwell and whether you should drink more or less or whatever. So we guide them as we go. Again, it's about, as Les said earlier, about their well-being, ensuring that they feel strong enough to enjoy their day and that they've got enough calories on board to manage that.
Who's going to say whether a patient would be better to come in for the day hospice or to stay at home and be visited? Is that a decision that the patient makes, or is that a decision that you will advise them?
It's a bit of both, because over this last year we've set up a referral centre with St Francis Hospice and the Peace Hospice in Hertfordshire, which centralises all referrals. And so often that referral is what we call triaged. It's assessed for where it's best for them to go. Very often a GP would ask for Rennie Grove Hospice at home. But my guide is if a patient's able to go to the hairdressers, they're really able to come to a clinic or come to day hospice. And I think they would benefit from day hospice. In reality, we do visit a lot of people who are still going out and about, but in a limited way. So there's not a defined line of saying you can't have hospice at home or you can't have day hospice. Well, you must do this. It's assessed on individual need to some degree.
As you said earlier, the developments in medical research and results of that research are going on all the time. And so does the role of a hospice just keep on changing?
It's not that many years ago, probably 10 years ago, when I think it was very obvious that if you went into a hospice, what was going to happen? And I think patients and families have been very worried about that. We've been worried about that as time's gone on, because that's not happening now. Patients will go into a hospice for a period of time, maybe to have their symptoms controlled or to have themselves assessed so that they can come home again. And then when they come home again, they're well. And they may be discharged from everybody. And I think the word hospice is a problem, but whatever we call ourselves will still be related to what we were. So it's getting our viewpoint and the message across that the word hospice doesn't mean that you go in and you die, that any hospice care is there to help you on every level of your illness, not just the symptoms, not just the diagnosis, but the impact of it on you personally, on your family. Because of course, the other thing that we rely on very heavily is family carers. We do spend a lot of time and resource on supporting carers. We have people who volunteer in our carer support group, because carers are now being asked in the home to do a lot of clinical things that not many years ago, the resources were there to do for them. But there's been cuts across the whole piece. So there's less nursing availability, there's less social care. So family carers are being asked to do a lot of monitoring, administering medication. In some instances, they're actually administering injections. They're trained by us. But it's a change in role, and they have to feel safe and secure to do that, because if they can't or they don't feel able to, then patients can't really stay at home. The government are driving people to stay at home. They don't want them to be admitted to hospital if it's not necessary. But families do need to feel safe to enable that to happen. So a lot of the care we give, both in day hospice and in the home, is to ensure they feel safe and cared for, and that they can ring us any time and someone will help them.
Thank you very much, Sue. Thank you, Les. Thank you very much for coming in. Now, you can find a whole lot more about this amazing organisation by looking at its website. That's rennygrove.org. There you'll find out about the range of services, as well as ways that you can volunteer or raise funds or simply donate.
It's time for In Concert. David Ireson tells Jill Burridge about some of the musical performances coming up in the area in the next few weeks.
Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined by David Ireson, and we're going to do another preview of the concerts and music that's coming up in St Albans and Hoppenden over the coming weeks. And perhaps we'll start, David, with a reminder about some of the concerts this weekend that we talked about last time we were on.
Yes, indeed. There's one tonight on Saturday the 23rd of March. The Imperial Male Voice Choir, conducted by Debbie Miles Johnson, is giving a concert in St John's Harpenden at 7:30, and a wonderful collection of stuff: folk songs, spirituals, opera choruses, all the stuff that, you know, we really like to hear male voice choirs sing. So that's on the 23rd, and then the next day, Sunday the 24th, this was a concert that we talked about last time, is a concert in given by the De Havilland Philharmonic in the Western Auditorium in Hatfield, of film music, with such favourites as Harry Potter, Pirates of the Caribbean, Star Wars, you know, all the popular stuff.
Nice, yes. Easy listening. That's an afternoon start.
It is.
Isn't
that's it? a 3 o'clock start in the afternoon.
Yeah. So that's Sunday, the 24th of March. Okay. So. That's the immediate future. But now looking ahead a little bit more, Saturday the 30th of March, Voix de Vivre are performing in St Peter's Church in St Albans at 7:30. That's sort of quite a mixed programme of music, isn't it?
It is. It's a pity. This is another day when we've got our frequent but unfortunate clashes, two concerts on the same night. Mm. Voix de Vivre in St Peter's, as you said, doing a programme of German choral music ranging from Bach to Schoenberg and including Brahms, Mendelssohn and Rheinberger on the way. The choir is conducted by Neil McKenzie and Alex Flood's the organist. The Bach is the Cantata 118 and the motet Com Jesu Com, Psalm 92 by Schubert, and three psalms by Mendelssohn, the opus 78. Brahms' Fest und Gedenksprüche, and the concert concludes with Schoenberg's Frieda auf Erden, opus 13. This is a bit of a challenge for choirs, the Schoenberg, though the music has been described as unsettlingly beautiful, and it's a good way of reminding ourselves that Schoenberg was, in fact, the last of the Romantic composers, extending the traditionally opposing schools of Brahms and Wagner, and was, without doubt, one of the most influential and important figures of 20th century music. The Nazis banned his music as degenerate because they were modernist and atonal, and he immigrated to the States in 1934. Some of his music is indeed atonal, which means it doesn't have a sort of central home key, though he himself disliked the term atonality, and he's probably best known for developing the 12-note technique. This is in which all the 12 notes of the chromatic scale have equal importance. So Frieda auf Erden, Peace on Earth, is a relatively early piece and well worth hearing as an introduction to what some people think of as a difficult composer. There was a famous story, I'm reminded, by Beecham, Thomas Beecham, of whom there are, the stories are legend, of course. Somebody once said to him something about Schoenberg. Did he know Schoenberg? No, he said, but I think I stepped in some once.
Oh, dear. Talk about prejudice.
Yes.
So that concert is on Saturday the 30th of March. It's Voix de Vivre. They're singing at St Peter's Church in St Albans. 7:30 is the start. That same evening, but over in Harpenden, the Harpenden Choral Society are going to be performing in the High Street Methodist Church.
Yes, they're doing Handel's great oratorio, Samson. The Bishop of London banned him from putting on biblical stories on the operatic stage.
Oh.
And that's really why we have oratorios, because thanks to the Bishop of London, and this sort of nonsense ruling that he made. That's why we have the Messiah, and the oratorio itself has a musical form.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
In fact, Handel began work on Samson immediately after Messiah and completed the first act in September 1741. The premiere was given in Covent Garden in February 1743 and was a great success, leading to a further 7 performances in its first season. That was the most that Handel had achieved. And it includes 2 famous arias, Total Eclipse, which is the moment when Samson is blinded, as a wonderful tenor aria, and the famous Let the Bright Seraphim for the soprano and trumpet. So to finish off our outing into this month's music and local concerts, here is a bit of Handel's wonderful aria, Let the Bright Seraphim.
I think that's been used on a few royal occasions, hasn't it?
It has indeed.
So stirring. So that's the 30th of March, just to recap, Harpenden Choral Society in the Methodist Church on the High Street in Harpenden, 7:30 start. So we move now to April, and the Lee Singers are hosting Bob Chilcott Singing Day. So this is St George's School in Harpenden.
That's right. His music was sung by Mosaic last month in their jazz concert at St Peter's. He's an ex-member of the King's Singers. This is Bob Chilcott. Mm. He is now a very successful composer and conductor, and I expect his day with the Lee Singers to be very popular. They will, of course, be working on his music, in particular 5 Days That Changed the World, River Bride, Evening Hymn, and a selection of jazz folk songs for choir. I think the day runs between 10 and 5. I think that's what happens. It starts at 10 o'clock in the morning and finishes at 5 in the evening. And it's a sort of bring, you know, you go to presumably take a packed lunch, yeah, and immerse yourself in Bob Chilcott's music for the day, led by the composer.
Very good indeed. So that's Saturday the 6th of April. The Lee Singers are hosting Bob Chilcott's Singing Day at St George's School, which is in Sun Lane in Harpenden. It might just, I guess the Lee Singers have got a website, so it might just be worth
indeed,
checking on
would.
A website.
Absolutely, yes.
But as you say, it could well be very popular because
I think it will be.
He's a local celebrity, really, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
The same evening, Saturday the 6th of April, that is, the St Albans Bach Choir are performing in the Cathedral in St Albans, 7:30. This is somewhat different, this programme.
Yes, this is another musical celebrity, John Rutter, who's coming to St Albans to conduct his Requiem and Magnificat. And they're also going to sing Bernstein's Chichester Psalms under their regular conductor, Andrew Lucas. Just before I say something about the Chichester Psalms, let's just have a listen to the Sanctus from John Rutter's Requiem.
Very popular piece of music,
yes,
that,
indeed,
isn't it?
Yeah. Deservedly so.
Yes.
Mm. Now, the Chichester Psalms, which is also in their programme, was commissioned for the 1965 Southern Cathedrals Festival, held that year at Chichester Cathedral, and was conducted by John Birch, who was then Master of the Music at Chichester. The Southern Cathedrals which take part in this festival are Chichester, Winchester and Salisbury. And the work was commissioned by Walter Hussey, who was then Dean of Chichester, and will be remembered as the champion of many works of art, music from Benjamin Britten, Edmund Rubra, Gerald Finzi, Malcolm Arnold, William Walton and Leonard Bernstein, painting from Graham Sutherland, a tapestry from John Piper, and stained glass by Marc Chagall. He was, you might say, quite a talent spotter.
He was.
And a huge supporter of art in the church. He was started off when he was at St Matthew's Northampton. That was where he was when he commissioned Britten to write Rejoice in the Lamb. And then the sort of commissioning habit became part of him, and he commissioned works of art right through until he retired from being Dean of Chichester.
He had a good eye and a good ear.
Absolutely. The Chichester Psalms is in 3 movements, scored for choir and orchestra, with a boy soloist. Leonard Bernstein stipulated that the solo part must be sung by a boy or a countertenor, but not a woman. I'm not sure how the present political climate would have coped with that. But, of course, the piece is it's Hebrew. I mean, it's in the Psalms, which comprise the text, are sung in Hebrew, which poses something of a problem for choral societies these days because some of the music goes along at a fair old pace.
Right.
And because, of course, there are no... Or when he wrote it, shall I put it, there were no women involved in Hebrew worship. I think in the 60s, probably was before the days of the first female rabbi. Oh. I don't know when Julia Neuberger came to prominence, but I suspect it was after the 60s.
Yes.
And so his stipulation that this part should be sung by a boy wasn't quite as horrendous as we think of it now.
No, well, at that time it wouldn't have raised an eyebrow, really.
No,
probably,
not really,
would it?
Not really, no.
But it will now.
Yeah, oh, it would now, yes. Yeah, but it's a great piece, really good piece.
So, and quite an amazing thing, we've got John Rutter conducting there.
Indeed.
Which is rather
yes,
nice.
Yes, yes. He's had quite a relationship with the Bach Choir. They've been up to and done concerts in the Albert Hall of his music, and he's certainly, I remember him coming down to St Albans when we made a disc of his music, and he was wasn't conducting but sat in the control room and gave it the okay.
Oh, good. So that's another concert on the 6th of April, the St Albans Bach Choir singing in St Albans Cathedral, starting at 7:30, and the programme is Rutter and Bernstein. And a third concert on Saturday, the 6th of April. Yes, what a choice we have. This is the Harding Choir, and they're singing at the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden.
They are. They're doing Rossini's Petit Messe Solennel. As I've remarked before, this piece is neither petite or solennel, and was described by Rossini, who had retired from composing operas 30 years before, as the last of the sins of my old age. It's deservedly popular with both singers and audiences, as this excerpt from it will demonstrate. This is the Et Vitam Venturi from the Creed of the Rossini Petit Messe Solennel.
Rossini's Petit Messe Solennel will be performed by the Harding Choir on Saturday, the 6th of April, at the High Street Methodist Church in Harpenden, and it starts at 7:30. The next day, Carillon are performing at St John's Church in Southdown in Harpenden. And they're doing what, David?
They're going to sing the Schütz Matthew Passion. It's going to start at 6:00. Admission is free because this is an attempt to bridge the gap between the concert platform and a church service. So the idea being that congregations can make it part of their keeping of Lent to hear the singing of the Passion, and people who like the music of Heinrich Schütz from a concert point of view are very welcome to come as well, of course. It lasts just under an hour. Rogers Covey Crump is the evangelist and William Houghton is Christ. The piece is unaccompanied because when it was written, instruments were not allowed in the chapel at Dresden, which is the place for which it was written. And another interesting feature is that the part of Judas is sung by what Schütz described as a falsettist. In other words, a false voice. We'd now call it a countertenor because countertenors are quite sort of ordinary now. But in those days... would be quite unusual, and he wanted the part of Judas, the betrayer of Christ, to be sung by a false voice. So we have a falsettist singing the part of Judas.
Right.
The performance will be repeated the following Sunday at St Saviour's Church, Sandpit Lane, also at 6:00, also free admission.
And you're involved with this?
I'm conducting both of those, yes.
Oh, right. Well, we should come along for moral support, David.
Okay.
You won't probably need it. There should be a full audience,
well,
I'm sure.
Well, I don't know.
Well, so those two performances by Carillon, the first on Sunday the 7th of April at St John's Church in Southdown, Harpenden, starting 6:00. And the following Sunday, the venue is St Saviour's Church in St Albans, again, a 6:00 start. And I think the performance is free. You don't need a ticket, but there's a retiring collection, obviously, to show your appreciation.
Indeed. And I should say there'll be a short talk before the performance 5 or 10 minutes, just, you know, setting the scene and explaining how it's, why it is like it is.
Yes, because I have to confess, I'd never heard of Heinrich Schütz.
No, well, the thing is about Schütz, if Schütz hadn't written his Passion, it's unlikely that Bach would have composed his, because Schütz was one of the first composers to do that. I'm something of a Schütz freak myself. I've always been a great fan of Heinrich Schütz. I sang in the Schütz choir under Roger Norrington for a long time, and I've tried to perform a lot of Schütz in my conducting ever since.
And to have got Roger's Klavierkrump as one of the soloists is quite something. Okay, so the last concert that we're covering this time is on the 27th of April. St Albans Chamber Choir are going to be performing in the Cathedral in St Albans, 7:30. This is Golden Jubilee Celebrations?
Yes, they've had a long relationship with a choir from Worms in Germany, the Wormser Kantorei, and they've gone over there and the Worms choir have come here for many years. Worms, of course, being, of course, the famous town for the Diet of 1521. Diet was an assembly of the Roman Holy Roman Empire to decide how to respond to the teachings of Martin Luther. And now I'm generally rubbish at remembering dates, but I can always remember 1521, like generations of schoolboys before me, because they call it the Diet of Worms.
Yes, I was going to say.
Anyway.
Much easier.
Yes. The programme will also include Mozart's Coronation Mass, written for the cathedral at Salzburg, where Mozart had just been appointed court organist and composer in 1779, after 18 fruitless months trying to get a job in Paris. It was certainly performed at the coronation of Francis II in 1792, and the Mass appears to have acquired the nickname the Königsmesse, the Coronation Mass, at the imperial court in Vienna in the early 19th century, after becoming a preferred work for royal and imperial occasions. It's easy to see why, as this should be so, as it's not very long and is definitely celebratory in style. And to give you a flavour of that, here's the start of the Gloria.
The Gloria from Mozart's Coronation Mass. What else is in the programme, David?
Also, there is Handel's Zadok the Priest and Vaughan Williams' Dona Nobis Pacem. Now, this is an interesting piece. Vaughan Williams wrote this cantata in 1936 to mark the centenary of the Huddersfield Choral Society. And he chose his texts, sections from the Mass, poems by the American poet Walt Whitman, a political speech from John Bright, who was trying at that time to prevent the Crimean War, and sections of the Bible. He wrote it as a plea for peace by referring to recent wars and amidst growing fears of a new one. The piece is scored for orchestra and choir and two soloists, a soprano and a baritone, and the movements are, the first one's called Agnus Dei, which is the last section of the Roman Catholic Mass, which ends with the words Dona Nobis Pacem, give us peace. The second movement is called Beat, Beat, Drums, which uses the first of the Whitman poems, describing the drums and bugles of war bursting through doors and windows and disturbing the peaceful lives of scholars, church congregations and bridal couples. The third movement, Reconciliation, another Whitman poem, which finishes with the words Dona Nobis Pacem, which is sung by the soprano and floats hauntingly over the voices of the chorus. Next movement, Dirge for Two Veterans, is another Whitman poem about the horrors of the Great War, in which Vaughan Williams himself served as an ambulance driver, so he knew all about it. And then the piece finishes with the John Bright speech, and finally another Dona Nobis Pacem. This was a really heartfelt piece for Vaughan Williams and deserves to be better known. It was given its first performance at the Proms in 1964, which was a long time after it was written, and it was repeated last year, as it happens, but it's only been performed at the Proms twice, which I would say was unusual for a major British choral work, and it certainly deserves to be better known than it is. Anyway, I think that the programme they've put together, an excellent combination of German and English music for such a special occasion for both choirs.
And I think we're going to finish today by hearing a little bit of the amazing Zadok the priest.
I thought it would be nice to finish with something suitably celebratory. Here's the first entry of the choir in Handel's great Zadok the priest. Now this, like the coronation mass of Mozart, Zadok the priest has been sung in every coronation since its composition in 1727 for the coronation of George II. So here's the first time the choir comes in Zadok the priest.
A rousing way to finish our preview of the music that's coming up over the end of March and April. And I should just say before we close that our next in concert will be the last weekend of April. So we'll hope to catch up with you then. Thank you for listening. And thank you very much, David, for taking us through the musical delights to come.
You're very welcome.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Nature Walk by Arian Lease, in its entirety. Thank you. Many thanks to Fran, Leslie, Jean and Fiona, our readers today. To Angela, who provided the radio listings, and to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. And we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in March 2019. Goodbye.